You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian, and our guest today is Jess Woodworth. She is a storyteller who is inspired by the stories of her childhood to write her very own. Based out of Los Angeles, she spends her time working on her manuscript, surrounded by her three dogs and drinking coffee. You can find her work and plenty of pictures of her dogs, too, at Cheshire Theory. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
What are you reading these days?
Oh my goodness. Well, The Tale of Despero has been the obviously most recent. And other than that, it's actually been, unfortunately, a lot of nonfiction and like looking into structures of stories and like dialogue and all of like the actual breakdowns of creating books.
That's so wonderful. I actually feel like that fits so well with this book. It's all about storytelling.
It is, which was actually very heartwarming while reading it. I was like, oh, the Once Upon a Time motif gets me. I think it probably is something that drew me to this book very early on. I've always been fascinated with storytelling for as long as I can remember. And so I think that Despero has some sort of special place in my heart because of his love of storytelling immediately upon his first time reading things. Such a fun parallel.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad. So today's book is from 2003, The Tale of Despero by Kate DiCamillo. I actually have my copy from childhood. It's my hardback. And I didn't realize it because, of course, it's written in silver gel pen. So it's really hard to read. But it says December 6, 2004 to Erin on her 7th birthday. Love, Mom and Dad, which I completely forgot about. Adorable. But I had remembered this as attached to third grade. And I think that would have been second grade for me. But what's your story with this book? Because I posted it as a list of topics I was interested in doing. And you said, cancel everything. Let's do this immediately.
I think it was probably about the same time for me. I think it was about second grade that I first read Despero. And I remember I also had the hardcover. I think I picked it up at like the school, you know, book fair. And I remember, one, immediately falling in love with the fact that, like, as I read the story, I also had this, like, tangible chewed upon, at, like,
yes,
the edges being chewed upon by the rats. Again, going back to just, like, it feels like you're reading a book about a story, you know, like, the echoes within echoes and the books within books. But I remember reading it relatively young and immediately loving how both magical but serious the book like took itself. Obviously there are these beautiful big images of like what it must be like to be this very tiny mouse in a very human world, but also these very real fears that like you can feel even now, like relating back to this mouse or this rat or this woman, you know, and revisiting it, I was reminded just how dark it was.
Yeah.
I've been drawn to dark stories my whole life. And I'm like, oh, this tracks that it probably started way, way back before I even realized, because there's some dark yeah, stuff in here.
Some of the darkest stuff is also the least fantastical, I guess.
Sure. The most grounded in like true realism.
Exactly.
And like probably the realities of living as like a rodent.
Absolutely.
As opposed to as a knight, even as a villain versus a rat. There's these two I think, very cool worlds that are explored. The fact that we have this, like, this knight in shining armor, which is, you know, our hero, who is really a, you know, 2-pound mouse. And then we have, like, our villain in this, you know, cape and crown and whatever, but really he's a rat and a spoon and a, you know, cloth, yeah. You know? So, like, really cool, like, the realities versus the world in which, like, these rats and mice live in, you know? I just remember being drawn to the cover. Yeah. I've always really, like, loved the image of the needle and the thread. And I think it's also probably where started my interest in stories about mice, which, as we, you know, you discussed on your story, there's so many of from childhood.
Yeah. Because when I initially started the podcast, it's almost been a year now, you were one of the first people I asked to come on and you wanted to do Redwall.
Yes.
Which I have not read Redwall. This conversation got me on to thinking of, God, how many rats in childhood media are there? And
so many.
And I love that this one is mice versus rats.
Right.
I mean, it won the Newbery that year. Kate DiCamillo is one of, I think, only 6 authors who've ever gotten 2 Newberries. I was going through, I didn't realize how much Kate DiCamillo had written, like, of the literary canon of, like, the aughts. She did Because of Winn-Dixie. She did The Tiger Floating, The Tiger Rising.
The Tiger.
Which I read, but obviously don't remember very much. And then I also looked into the illustrator, Timothy Basil Ehring. I found almost nothing on him. Like, the internet hasn't heard from him since 2009. And I think the book would not be the same without these illustrations. I have very strong opinions about all these black and white pencil sketches.
I agree. I also have very vivid memories of them.
Yeah.
From childhood. Like, as I turned pages and got to them in this one, I was like, oh my God, that's right. Oh, yep, there's that one. And, like, they came back in, like, such vivid ways of, like, yep, I remember, like, the first time that I, like, flipped to that page and saw, you know, a rat losing his tail. Even just, like, the way that these two, like, or even 3 worlds are depicted in this imagery. Again, I think that goes back to this ability to create both this fantastical and realistic. And these pencil sketches do a great job of that.
Yeah.
There's something intrinsically whimsical about them.
I still don't have the exact word for it, because they're intense with the black and white, and obviously a character is named Chiaroscuro, talking about contrast and light and his whole storyline. I think I might have said this before we started recording. This book just felt overall so life affirming. And I feel like the books that have been most impactful over the course of doing this podcast are the ones that really treat kids as full, whole, complex adults. Beings. And I think the wonderful thing that this book does, that I think I love throughout media, is saying, like, the hard things happen and the good things happen too. And we will get through it. And there is as much light as there is dark. And how sort of, like, forthright and simple and firm that is here. I love it.
I agree. I think there's something very, as you just said, this idea of, like, treating children with, like, the respect that they deserve. I feel like this book does, like you said, a great job of balancing these two things, the beauty and the grotesque. Like you said, some of these images are, like, fucking frightening.
Yeah. These are
and
not.
Other are beautiful.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, really have, like, a sense of wonder and softness. And you can tell that by just how much darkness is pressed down into these pencil sketches at any given point, where we are in the world, how dark it is, and how dark some of these scenes, you know, feel. Because there are just some things that, like, even as a kid, I was like, wow, that's, like, a really big reveal that, like, is treated very much just like, that's just life.
Yeah, there's some such intense moments of heartbreak and betrayal just in the first, I guess it's what, 4 books total? Yeah,
yeah.
4 books total. And the first one is just somehow the mouse world feels like the least magical and maybe the darkest because of just how much Despero doesn't fit in. I love also one last thing on the illustrations for now. I love that you use the word softness. I think that's exactly the description of it, of these illustrations. But at the end of the third chapter, it's like, write it, 25 pages. I think it might be the first intercut like this. Reader, you must know that an interesting fate, sometimes involving rats, sometimes not, awaits almost everyone, mouse or man, who does not conform.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like a rocket takes off. Like, here we go. We're launching. And I loved it. I loved it. There's such a, not only a love of the audience and kids, but just like everyone here loves stories. Everyone here loves the act of storytelling.
True. That's so true. Oh, I love the word rocket because that's so accurate. You like feel it in your chest. You're like, yes, okay, let's go.
Yeah, it's like somebody kicks down a door and a guitar solo or like riff starts. Let's do back of the book story overview. Despero is, let me just actually read it right here. This is the story of Despero Tilling, a mouse in love with music, stories, and a princess named P. It's also the story of a rat called Roscuro, who lives in darkness but covets a world filled with light. And it is the story of Migory Sow, a slow-witted serving girl with a simple, impossible wish. These characters are about to embark on a journey that will lead them down into a horrible dungeon, up into a glittering castle, and ultimately into each other's lives. And what happens then? Reader, it is your destiny to find out.
So fun.
Like the images and like icons of it are so clear. It's every page that introduces a chapter has this like ring around it. And there's so many good visuals of this, of like the thread and all the soup and the ladle and the needle and the spoons and all of this. It's yeah. And it being mice, maybe here's, am I having a lightning bolt moment? Do we have a lot of children's media about mice because mice are small and scurry through the world as a toddler scurries? So the things that are on mice eye level are also perhaps on child eye level. Like these are all things that might be maybe less the spoons, but like if you're a baby and you're crawling on the ground and you like knock over your mother's sewing box, then you've got the thread, you've got needles.
I'm interested. I see where you're, I see the brain thread here. And I'm interested, I really like this imagery, I guess, even of just being small in the world and like how that must, and I mean, obviously having been small, but like how that must feel, right? Like mm-hmm. that feeling of things being bigger than they maybe are. And especially for something like mice, big human adult problems seem so far away and like so inconsequential compared to the things that they are immediately dealing with, which I think does have a lot of like childlike wonder properties to it, you know, yeah. Of like, oh, you see this world through what directly is affecting you kind of at that point in your life. And those things are so much more immediate and feel so much bigger, even if they aren't necessarily big to the people around you. They are genuinely big to you.
Yeah.
Which is a theme, I guess, in this book, especially, right? Like an inconsequential cutting off of a mouse's tail is a giant deal to our, you know, protagonist. And I think that like, that is something that definitely feels like it parallels with kids, you know, of yeah. like these adult things feel far away and, you know, maybe they are a big deal. Maybe they also seem ridiculous and mm-hmm. why are they rules and why does it matter? But your problems seem big and giant and nobody seems to notice them as big and giant. I mean, especially even when we get to the third book, which is, I think, ultimately the most devastating of oh. all the books.
Mm-hmm.
Just like rereading it, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
This is dark.
Yeah.
I remembered it being dark and I still was kind of taken aback by just how much abuse is mentioned in the yeah. book. And obviously there are terrible things that happen to characters far prior to this. But just like her fate the whole time being that nobody ever asks her what she cares about and nobody ever asks her what she wants. And I feel like there are definitely points in childhood where everyone can relate to that, where it feels like yeah. nobody sees you or nobody asks you, hey, what do you want? Because everybody is just running around doing their life and you're just kind of at the mercy of whatever they say that you're doing at that time because you're just a kid. And so I think that there, with all of our characters, there's things that people can relate, especially children, can mm-hmm. relate back to. And I think especially children that are feeling like they are othered in some kind of way, shape, and form, and how you can find your happily ever after, even if it isn't the conventional happily ever after you were seeking.
Yeah.
This book is actually what made me want to take French.
Okay.
And it's because I remember early on being like, oh, okay, so like these words, and obviously like I knew, like there's a bunch of points in the book where it's like, reader, do you know what this word means? Mm-hmm. You probably should, because I'm going to use it a lot. But there's also, especially early on, the introduction of Despereaux's mother. Mm-hmm. And her being French, and she says, you know, many French words, adieu being one of them, which I love that end of that moment.
Yeah, I was looking at that.
Farewell can't be beautiful. Let me see where that directly is.
Here, I got it. I was looking at it right before we logged on. Adieu is the French word for farewell. Farewell is not the word that you would like to hear from your mother as you are being led to the dungeon by two oversized mice in black hoods. Words that you would like to hear are, take me instead. I will go to the dungeon in my son's place. That's page 65 of a 260-page book.
Yes. I believe right after that, it even launches into saying that it's not beautiful in any language, you know?
Yep.
But reader, there's no comfort in the word farewell, even if you say it in French. Farewell is a word that in any language is full of sorrow. It is a word that promises absolutely nothing. And I think that like those moments were some of the moments where I was like, okay, this like very beautiful language also is very sad. And ironically, and I don't know how ironic it is, I guess, but the tale of Despereaux actually translates to the tale of despair. His name is despair, which makes sense when you first take off into the first chapter and it's her being so upset and disappointed in the fact that all of her babies have basically died except for this very, very tiny mouse. And it seems that all of her, you know, births have been just going worse and worse as she's gotten older. So she's like, well, this is the last one. And she's, you know, it makes sense that she's sad when she names him, because they kind of are like, name the boy.
Yeah.
Name the small bundle of fluff. And I think it's so interesting to like watch how this tale of sadness, you know, and despair really is explored throughout the book, you know, not only the tale of this mouse, but also just all of these tragedies that befell all of these parties and how they overcome it.
Yeah. You touched on it a little bit ago about that moment. Migori Sao is one of our big characters, and she is a serving girl who whose father sold her for, I think, a couple chickens and like a tablecloth.
It's a hen, some cigarettes.
Oh, that's the part. Cloth. The cigarettes.
And I think that is also like such a fucking, like, it's not even something permanent. Mm-hmm. It's not something that lasts. It's clear to us that the tablecloth lasts and that the hen was a relatively good hen, but the handful of cigarettes gets me every time, because it's like, wow, it really was just like this disposable thing that was going to burn away.
And she has this sort of recurring experience of nobody ever asks her what she wants. It's a lot of, she'll say something is wrong. She'll say, I don't like this. And people will just say, who cares? And so the climax of the entire book is when Migori Sao has helped Roscuro the rat kidnap the Princess P. And Princess P looks at Migori Sao and says, well, what do you want? And I am looking for the exact moment. But that's the moment that changes everything, is someone just asks this girl, what do you want? And treats her like a human being and an equal. And that shook me to my core, that moment, because I have been working on this screenplay that's a horror movie for a year or two. And one of the first sort of like clearest statements of like what the thesis was to me in working through it was that it's okay to want. It is okay to want things. It's not a crime to want things. And that's something I'm still, you know, taking apart 17 years later or something. Really shocked me.
Yeah, I think that especially when you look at the fact that she was also punished for wanting.
Yeah,
No, like
absolutely.
I know I mentioned the abuse, but they talk about the fact that many characters just totally what is the word that they use? Club? Did they say
Yeah,
club her
something like
ears?
her. Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, like, that's such intense imagery of, there's a point where it is explicitly mentioned that she has turned, I think, 7. And, oh yes, she has just turned 7. It's her birthday. She sees the princess and she can't hear her because of how much she has, like, endured these beatings to her ears, like, over time. Her hearing has just turned from having actual sharp senses to being really
She's hard of
strained
hearing,
ears.
yeah.
And I even have it here. The less she heard, the less she understood. The less she understood, the more things she did wrong. And the more things she did wrong, the more clouts, there it is, clouts to the ears she'd received, and the less she heard.
Yeah.
This is what is known as a vicious cycle. And I think that that is, again, another really common motif in this book is vicious cycles. You know, we see it as early as Despero wanting to just read books and everybody thinking that he is not mouse enough, you know, not acting enough like a mouse, not being enough like everyone else. And because of that vicious cycle, it ends with him not being like a mouse and risking, quote unquote, everything that the Mouse Council has ever taught him. And because he breaks that vicious cycle, his story begins. It's really interesting how early we're introduced to that concept, but how late it's actually like broken down for us in this very specific moment because of just how vicious her cycle is.
God, your heart breaks for her. All of this is set off by the death of her mother, I think, is sort of the last person who really took care of her. And she's getting ready to say goodbye to her mother. And Migori says, but I want you to stay here. And her mother, her dying words say, ah, child, what does it matter what you are wanting? And then she died.
What does it matter? And then she hears it over and over and over. And I think there's the beauty also of her losing her mom and P losing her mom.
Yes.
And the synergy that these two characters feel as a part of different worlds as they are. P loses her mom to, you know, who is a loving, devout mother as far as we are, you know, introduced in flashbacks and otherwise. She loses her to an unexpected death while also relatively young. And the girls are about the same age when they actually finally meet. And that synergy of, oh, well, there is these similarities between our two worlds, regardless of the fact that P comes from a world where she has gotten everything she has ever wanted her entire life. And Mitch has got nothing, you know? And despite that, they both have the same thing of no matter what they wanted, they both lost the person that they care about, which was their mom.
Yeah, that's the biggest moment in the book where P says, what do you want? Migori says, I want my ma. And P says, I want my mother too. Yeah, so much about this book is just about reaching out and the ways that you can reach out and that the world gets kinder just by reaching out and crossing those gaps. Yeah, it's, what a book.
Book. I think that I know we haven't talked much about book two.
Go for it.
I love book two.
Book two is about our rat Roscuro.
Yes. Roscuro is introduced basically under the premise of doing a pretty awful thing that you don't realize is an awful thing off the bat. He's just chewing on a rope and he gets in trouble with the jailer, whose name is Gregory, because he refuses to apologize or think that he did anything wrong. Gregory basically takes a match to the side of his face and burns off the left whiskers off of like the whole left side of his face. And then in all of these beautiful pencil drawings from there on out, you actually can see that he has like little nubs, which is pretty interesting. I'm like, okay, so like attention to detail was there.
These images are harrowing sometimes.
They really are. But I think the fact that we are introduced to him under like this really terrible thing happening to him, for what seems kind of like a not a terrible crime. And we later find out that it kind of is a terrible crime. So it makes sense why Gregory is as irritated as he is. But I think that we learn very, very quickly just how evil he is set up to be by rat society. Like, that is like the baseline expectation, like torture, manipulation. Like, it is said numerous times that just evil is part of being a rat.
Yeah, the sort of second in both mouse and rat worlds, we have our main character and then we have sort of the sidekick that kind of sets the tone of with Despero, it's his brother, with Roscuro, it's Botticelli. And Botticelli's repeated refrain is just like, how can I get the most suffering possible out of this situation? It is not in a negative way. It is on the nose. It is straightforward.
Right. There is like no ambiguity about the fact that he is a bad, bad character. Yeah. And like there is even numerous times where he's being manipulative in dialogue and the book still is explicitly clear. Like, reader, we all know that he is evil though, and you cannot trust him. And the fact that it is so adamant about being like, no, bad.
Yeah.
Bad, evil, bad. But they never treat Roscuro that way. They constantly treat him just like his name implies, which is, like you said, the duality of light and dark and the entanglement of the two of them, which, going back to this very first moment in book two, when the flame is brought up to his face and his whispers are burned off, it also ignites this interest in the light.
Yes.
That becomes an obsession for him, you know, and that obsession leads him to both joy and also the evil that unfortunately the darkness, you know, represents inside of him. And it triggers both of those things, you know, it triggers this interest in the light that draws him forth to the party upstairs, and he finds joy and interest, and he's like, wow, this is everything I ever wanted. The glittering lights, the dancing, the music. And he waltzes into the party and he's enjoying everything. And because P is just a little girl and points him out, he falls into soup and basically ruins the entire kingdom in P's opinion.
Kills her mom.
Kills her mom, gets soup banned, gets rats banned, but what are you going to do about banning rats? Which the book makes explicitly clear there are hundreds of rats in the dungeon below the castle. As he's running away, he's apologetic and he feels terrible, but he also kind of doesn't, I realize. Like, he's like, sorry, right? But there's also like a point of the book which made me laugh out loud when I was reading it this time, where it basically is like, yeah, he thought that it was time to excuse himself. Like, it was about time to just go. Like,
while everyone is like weeping over the body.
Probably true. Probably time to go. However, I'm not sure if that was supposed to be as funny as it was. But, you know, as he runs away, he remembers the, you know, maybe I should look back. Maybe looking back will make me feel, you know, better, because I will see, you know, I'll still have seen the light. And I'll see, and then when he looks back, he sees P glaring at him.
Yes.
Valid. Just killed my mom, yo. But at that moment, he like decides that he is going to take revenge on this little girl, which I think is so interesting, because it's so quick that he flips from being like, oops, that was really bad of me, to being like, actually, I hate you, and I'm going to obsess about hating you, and I'm taking this spoon. He takes his mom's spoon, or her mom's spoon, and wears it as a crown for the next, you know, years.
It's that look of horror and rage that she, her eyes were filled with disgust and anger. And that is his turning point, that single moment. But the way she phrases it is that that look broke his heart.
Yes.
But that is how it phrases it. It goes, did you think that rats do not have hearts? Wrong. All living things have a heart, and the heart of any living thing can be broken.
And I think right before then also, while he is hanging from the chandelier.
Mm-hmm.
When Princess P points him out and says, rat, there's a rat hanging from the chandelier. Oh, here, yes. Okay. A rat, she shouted. A rat is hanging from the chandelier. The party, as I have noted, was loud. The minstrels were strumming and singing. The people were laughing and eating. The man with the jingle cap was juggling and jingling. No one in the midst of all their merriment heard the pea. No one except Roscuro, rat. He had never before been aware of what an ugly word it was. Rat. In the middle of all that beauty, it immediately became clear it was an extremely distasteful syllable. Rat. A curse. An insult. A word totally without light. And not until he heard it from the mouth of the princess did Roscuro realize that he did not like being a rat, and he did not want to be a rat. This revolution hit Roscuro with such force that it made him lose his grip on the chandelier. The rat, reader, fell. And I think that is also so interesting, right? It's just before this look of disgust and this look of anger and this thing that breaks his heart, he realizes he doesn't want to be what he is, and he doesn't really get to stop being it. And he doesn't realize that, I don't think, until he looks back and P is looking at him like a rat that he has been expected to be his whole life. And I think it's almost the like self-fulfilling prophecy of, if you see me as a monster, I will be the monster that you see. It's so interesting how many times it also says rat over and over and over, this nasty word, this word that is devoid of light. It is distasteful, a curse, an insult. Mm-hmm. Like, all of those are such poignant words to be like, yep, this is all of the negative feelings building up inside of him at this moment of what he is and what he quote unquote can't escape being. And in doing that, he dooms all the rats, but he also doesn't, because ultimately the rats just continue to live in the darkness the way they always have. And so he doesn't really get the consequence of hurting rats because it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But there is consequence for everyone else. You know, P loses her mom. The king loses his wife. The cook can no longer cook soup. Despero is adjacent to a rat. And for that reason alone, the king is like, you can't be anywhere near my daughter. And it sets off the course of events of, you know, everything going terribly wrong. For Despero anyway. And so it's interesting that it can all be directly traced back to this moment where Roscuro is just so entangled with the light and the beauty of everything. And because the world cannot see him as beautiful, it turns everything for the worse, you know?
Yeah. Wow. I love that. It's really reminding me of how much in this moment, I mean, what a passage. Roscuro realizing and reckoning with what he is, how other people see him, of defining what a rat is. And Despero is also dealing with not conforming, like we said, to the definition of what a mouse is supposed to be. And Despero also has this magical moment with P and sort of decides that, I mean, maybe the thing that makes it different is that Despero is rejected by mice. Well, no, because Roscuro is also. But that Despero similarly is plagued by the ways that he does not fit into the definition of what a mouse is, and yet uses that and sort of says like, well, that's what I am and that's what it is. So I'm going to be these other things, and having to find solutions outside of that definition, outside of the familiar world.
Yes. I'm curious if it's the fact that, like you said, Despero doesn't view himself in totality as a mouse. He views himself as a knight. He is fulfilling this role that he believes he should be, the protector. I think he even refers to himself many times. Like he's supposed to protect the pea. Like he's supposed to protect Princess Pea. And it's made explicitly clear that he is in love with her.
Yes.
Which I think is like one of my favorite moments of the book is the untangling of everything when it is just like telling everybody is happily ever afters, and it explicitly is like, Yeah, no, he still loves her, but also, mm-hmm. yes, we also recognize he is a mouse and she is a human, but they're good friends.
Yes. Yeah.
It's... And I was like, oh, that's beautiful. Like, it's such all of these very beautiful messagings, mm-hmm. you know, but I think that, like you said, he kind of rejects this mouseness early on because of his love for specifically the princess.
Mm-hmm.
And he also approaches very slowly and very gently. And I'm curious too how much, and obviously the book doesn't necessarily explicitly say this anywhere, but I'm also curious how much the experience with Rescuro changed her even, because we do get a whole passage about her empathy, right? And we get a whole bunch of information about how the princess's heart works. And even though it doesn't necessarily go over any kind of forgiveness with Rescuro in that moment, there is this like recognition of she is very, very capable of being empathetic and like seeing things from other points of view and things like that. And when she meets Rescuro again, her reaction to him, even though she is like held at knife point in that moment, again, such a dark book. Even though she's held at knife point in that moment, she's very brave and very well-spoken and very smart still. Like, she honestly is even kind of bitchy at one point and, like, sassy.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it. Yeah.
You really are privileged. But I guess you can be sassy with a rat that killed your mom and is now holding you at knife point using your maid. I think that's an appropriate person to be sassy at.
Oh, but there's such a scary, skin crawly moment where he's like, you got to get up. We got to go. And she goes, okay, but someone needs to do the buttons on my dress. And Rescuro's like, I'm smarter than that. She's not going to put down the knife. I will button your buttons on your dress. And it's, oh, yucky.
And he does it so smoothly too. And the way it's written is just so villainous, because like it immediately conjures up the image of this rat crawling all over her.
Yeah,
like it's very like, yep, the knife is still pointed at her and the rat is crawling all over her back. And
it's interesting that that is not the illustration we get for that chapter.
No,
because the illustration is just the moment before where they're waking her up in bed.
Yeah, and I think that this is also a pretty spooky image.
Yes,
it's definitely not as visceral, but I think that this image is so interesting because it gives us three very distinct characters all in various states of color. So like Princess P is super lightly drawn. I know that nobody is going to be able to see this, so I'm going to describe it the best I can, but like she's almost white, you know, like everything around her is much darker. And even like the sketchings for her like hairlines and her eyes are super, super light. And so then when you like look at the other two characters in frame, both Midri and Rescuro, you have Midge in this almost gray. and she goes from already darker than pea gray in her face, but even darker as you go down her body into like her clothes and whatnot. And then you have Rescuro, who is almost entirely just like a black mass on her shoulder. And obviously there's like the play of the candle and how like that's bouncing around the space, but also how beautiful to like show these characters in various states of gray, a true grayscale analysis of like what a pure quote unquote character is with very few flaws, to like a more gray character that is very flawed but is really just trying their best, all the way over to this like evil quote unquote character that is really being driven by evil and anger and hatred. Yeah. Lots of hatred at that point, specifically directed at P, and he doesn't really care who else he hurts to hurt her.
Yeah. And he has that sort of mentality like everyone else, that like the maximum amount of suffering is the best amount of suffering.
Right.
Yeah.
I know I mentioned that the chewing through the rope was a terrible thing. And I didn't necessarily say why, but later on, it is explicitly clear that he chews through Gregory's rope to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And it works.
Yes.
And they're like, we went down into the dungeon to find the princess, and we just found a dead jailer. Oh no, poor Gregory. And then we just move on. And like, Gregory actually is a pretty good guy. He's who gets Despero out of the dungeon. Mm-hmm. He does it very skillfully. He's not necessarily a good guy. He does it because Despero can give him something.
Yes.
But he holds to his word, and he, you know, does in fact actually get Despero out of the dungeon and back upstairs. But the fact that it's just explicitly like, Roscuro finished what he started so long ago, chewed right through that rope, and you know, Gregory died. And it's just like, okay.
On to the next. But I think that's sort of the attitude that the narrator has to almost everything of like, that's life, baby, on to the next.
Yep. Sometimes things die. Sometimes people die.
I just flipped to the line. I think in maybe Despero's first interaction with Gregory at the very end of the first book, Despero says, why would you save me then? And Gregory says, because you, Mouse, can tell Gregory a story. Stories are light. Light is precious in a world so dark. Begin at the beginning. Tell Gregory a story. Make some light.
Mm-hmm.
That idea of make some light by storytelling. It's so good. And then the next book immediately starts, and Roscuro's whole thing is about light and being a rat obsessed with light is as sort of preposterous as a mouse in love with a princess. But there's this, the moment where it happens is the door to the dungeon opens and all the rats look away except for Roscuro. And it says, Roscuro, however, stared directly into the light. Reader, this is important. The rat called Chiaroscuro did not look away. He let the light from the upstairs world enter him and fill him. He gasped aloud with the wonder of it. The moment when Despero, I think, first hears music is very similar. It's just gorgeous.
So it's beautifully written. And like, we find out later where it was coming from, obviously where the music was coming from, but also even going back to like finding where he first heard the sounds when he was like laying awake with his eyes open. These like callbacks to moments in earlier chapters are so beautiful and so fun.
Like you said earlier with Vicious Cycles, it's so circular, which I think is like a storyteller's favorite thing, is when everything comes together and you can tie in all the edges.
Tell me more. And how is she involved?
Exactly.
Speaking of this end of the first book, this image.
Yes.
Haunting. It has Gregory with his giant ear. It is a massive ear held up with the tiny little mouse of Despero, who, again, we have established many a time in the book, is very tiny, even by mouse standards. And he has this, like, side eye going. So that he can, like, be looking towards Despero, who is being held by his ear to whisper the story into said ear.
The whole look is lecherous. It's,
it really is.
And, it's like, yucky. You
know, the, like, hair that you can make out even in the darkness that like is covering his chin, and he has like long kind of like stringy looking hair that is very clearly graying, and then this almost dunce looking cap,
yes,
which is interesting,
confusing old-timey hat, certainly,
yeah, for sure. And then around his wrist he has like shackles going on, which is interesting because we are told in the book that his rope is around his ankle.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting that he also is wearing shackles.
Yeah.
Because he's the jailer, not a prisoner.
Prisoner unless.
At least from what we're told.
Right.
But he does live down in the dungeon. So ? Read into that old timiness however you want.
Yeah, that is, what an image.
Again, all of the imagery in this book is so visceral. And again, going back to the hardcover, having the detail of all of the pages have this nibbling effect on the edge of it. And we're told in book one that is a pretty common snack, basically,
yes,
for the mice. And it's actually what starts Despero's love of books, is he's able to read and none of the other mice are. So they all are like, yeah, scribbly scrabble, chew the paper. And he's like, but no, I need to finish the story. Don't eat my story. That's rude. And he's right. But the lovely detail of the hardcover, like so many small details like that, like giving the reader, especially a young reader, those like tangible, real feeling moments of like, oh my gosh, that's so magical and mystical in its own right.
I noticed my copy, at least, is from Candlewick Press, who also do the Ologies books, Dragonology. I thought that was very interesting, and how they make a book feel like an artifact adds so much to it, especially when it's about the art of storytelling.
And I remember, obviously, I've been reading the paperback this time, but I remember as a kid holding that book and even seeing it in your hands now, and like how it is shaped just like your stereotypical storybook. Yes. Like it is the right size. It is the right, like, heftiness. And like this story in and of itself is not a very long story.
No.
And it is a pretty quick read, but it has a way of feeling substantial even in your hands, like you are holding this magnificent storybook. Very similar to when you hold the really chunky Grimm's Tale books, you know, that actually have a lot of stories within them. And I think that that goes, you know, hand in hand with the four book concept. And again, none of the books are very long. And these obviously are all telling the same story, ultimately. But the fact that, like, it feels like a storybook that you would have in a wondrous sort of world.
I would like to suggest Horvis, the Threadmaster. This character I loved.
Me too.
Horvis makes, I think, two major appearances. One is in the first book. He is the Threadmaster, who is the mouse equivalent sort of to an executioner, and attaches Despero to this red thread as he's about to go into the dungeon and presumably be eaten. And the Threadmaster hears the whole story. Despero says, I love this princess. And the mouse say, you can't be friends with humans. And the Threadmaster whispers, is she beautiful? Is the princess beautiful? And he goes, just right. A lovely princess, just so, like a fairy tale. And you love her as a knight loves a maiden. You love her with a courtly love, a love that is based on bravery and courtesy and honor and devotion. Just so. Be brave, friend. Be brave for the princess. So he sends Despero on his way into the lion's den at the same
time.
At the same time being like, I heard, I believe, I speak the same language as you. You're not alone. Goodbye. And I like, and then later in the fourth act or the fourth book, he comes back and gives Despero the thread to help him save the princess. And there's another beautiful scene. Despero asks, says he doesn't know his name, says, oh, it's Horvis, excuse me, not Horvis. It's Horvis. And he gives Despero the needle to use as a sword. And he gives him a piece of thread to, he chews through the piece of thread that he had originally tied on Despero's neck and said, there, now you're free. You see, you're not going into the dungeon because you have to, you're going because you choose to. And he introduces Despero to the word quest. It's just, it's so gorgeous when, like I was saying earlier, just to reach out that someone is there saying like, I know you and I believe you.
I think it's also imperative just like how important he is and like, oh yes, he mattered as a character because he's actually the last character mentioned in the entire book by name, which I think is really, really fascinating, right? We end on Despero's family looking upon him, right? And with Horvis, which I think is very, very interesting and just very telling just how important of a character he is for someone who just got a name in this last act. I was gonna say in act four it's really, really cool because Despero, while pushing the thread, actually begins telling his own story to himself, which I think is super, super cool because there's this moment where it even says something along the lines of, you know, dear reader, it's not a tale that unlike this one, you know, it's very similar to this one. And I think like that's also very beautiful. again, going back to holding a very tangible book that is like, oh my gosh, this is almost like a story that was written and pulled from that very library.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it connects to the very mice. And it's very beautiful. And again, I think that, like, going back to storytelling and the bravery which comes from, you know, and the light that comes from storytelling, that particular moment happens just as he is descending into the dungeon, like you said, because he wants to, because he is choosing to go down there to save the princess. And it's while, you know, thinking about those things that he actually loses the thread and, like, fear comes upon him. But he knows that the story cannot end with him, you know, fleeing back up the stairs and, you know.
Yeah.
So he continues to descend down into the darkness. And I think there's something very lovely about him talking about his story up to this point, which is, for Despero, only happening over the course of, like, a couple of days. From, like, the point in which he first discovers the Princess P to all of this. Having to save her life. But the fact that he is, like, telling his story up to this point, and you can almost imagine that he's, like, getting up to the point in his story here of, he has gone down to the dungeon already once, he has escaped, he has fallen in love with the princess, and then you have the fact that as he returns, he's, like, lost his tail and he gets covered in flour, which then has most of the mice council believe that he's returned as a ghost.
Yes, and his father, that's such a heartbreaking moment. His father starts begging for forgiveness,
which his brother never does.
That's true.
I just want to touch on the fact we didn't actually say this, but his brother delivers him. He is one of those mice that is, you know, the lumbering mice that scare Despero as they're coming to take him away to the dungeon. And after, you know, the Threadmaster moment. And as they're walking, his brother speaks to him, and Despero recognizes his voice and pleads to his brother, like, no, please, like, don't do this. Why would you do this? Like, you're my brother. And doesn't care. Doesn't flinch. And then fast forward, I was like, okay, dad gets a redeeming moment. Where's Furloughs? Yeah. You know, Lester got one. Where's Furloughs? Fast forward all the way to the end, and even Furlough's last thing is cripes, says Furlough. Unbelievable. And I'm like, you little brick.
I know. I read that and I was like, oh no, the world is not cured. It really freaked me out. But I wanted to go back to that scene where Lester, his father, asks for forgiveness, because it's such an emotionally mature sequence, and it's paralleled by an equally powerful moment at the beginning when Lester sends his son into the dungeon.
Yes.
But Lester says, forgive me. Forgiveness, reader, is, I think, something very much like hope and love, a powerful, wonderful thing, and a ridiculous thing too. Isn't it ridiculous, after all, to think that a son could forgive his father for beating the drum that sent him to his death? Isn't it ridiculous to think that a mouse could ever forgive anyone for such perfidy? And then Despero does forgive him. Mm-hmm. And he said those words because he sensed that it was the only way to save his own heart, to stop it from breaking in two. Despero, reader, spoke those words to save himself.
Mm-hmm.
Which but before I forget it, I want to bring it back to this amazing moment, again, in that climax with Magritte and P. I think, reader, that she, P, was feeling the same thing that Despero had felt when he faced with his father begging him for forgiveness. That is, P was aware suddenly of how fragile her heart was, how much darkness was inside it, fighting always with the light. She did not like the rat. She would never like the rat, but she knew what she must do to save her own heart. And so here are the words that the princess spoke to her enemy. She said, Briscuro, would you like some soup? Goddamn.
I know we haven't even really touched on the soup much, but, like, there are some really beautiful moments about the soup.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually one of the parts that stuck with me the least. And so upon rereading, I was like, whoa, these are some really, like, there's a whole moment with the cook. I also just love how many women are in this book.
It's almost all except for Gregory and the King.
I think.
It's, yeah.
And the dad.
Yes, Lester, yes.
But, oh, I meant Midri's dad.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I do feel we're like, oh, except for this guy. Oh, and also this guy.
And also that guy. Also Death also, yeah. Also all of our main characters except for me. Also. most of the humans are women.
Yes.
Most.
That's true. Yeah.
And I think that it's really interesting because the cook, we are initially introduced in a very scary scene because it's actually Despero's first moment out of the dungeon. And he's almost killed. He has, you know, a knife swung at him. It misses. and we get a great image of a cleaver cutting off his tail and his tail on one side of the cleaver and his body flinging to the other side of the cleaver.
Which I never, when I look at the cover, I never think, oh, that's a mouse without a tail.
Yeah.
That's just a little guy. So every time, so I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, that is something I should be paying attention to. Cause he looks so, so isolated, you know, because he's so small.
So that's the first time we meet her. Mm-hmm. And it's very scary. You're experiencing it from Despero's tiny little perspective of, oh my God, I'm about to die.
Yeah, he looks like he's fainted in it. Yeah, he looks dead.
And it's not until he has gotten the thread from the Threadmaster and he has to traverse this kitchen to get back down to the dungeon. And he comes upon the cook, like awake in the middle of the night, hush hush, making soup.
I know, making contraband soup. Yeah.
Contraband soup. Like, she's so scared that it's gonna be like one of the king's men that when she sees that it's the mouse, she's like relieved and like, oh my gosh, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm so happy you're a mouse and not a man. We choose the bear, you know.
well
she's like, well, you know, it's actually, oh, here it is, and I'm kidding myself, there ain't no point in making soup unless others eat it. Soup needs another mouth to taste it, another heart to be warmed by it. And like, she then turns to Despero and says, mouse, would you like some soup? And there's something so beautiful about that post her cutting off his tail and trying to kill him and saying, like, I believe she even says, like, the only good mouse is a dead mouse. And,
yes,
like, but then she asks, you know, Despero, like, how the soup is and like if it's missing anything or if she put too much of anything. And like, she tells him, you know, like, this is a treaty that only lasts right now in this moment, and tomorrow I would kill you again, but, you know, go save the princess. There's something very, like, telling about just how true that line about, like, it warms your heart, because her heart was not warm a moment ago. And also, it's been banned since the queen's death. And since then, basically, everything has only gotten worse and worse and worse and sadder and sadder and sadder for the kingdom. It's such a well-told story in, like, the way that all of these elements are both very obvious and yet nuanced, if that makes sense.
Like,
they're not complicated by any means, and they're very, like, simple concepts of basic storytelling premises of good versus evil, but there's also so much nuance about, like, forgiveness and like, understanding and finding your happiness even if it's not, like, what your dream necessarily was. Because we haven't really talked about the fact that the reason she goes along with Rescuro's plan, why Midri goes along with Rescuro's plan, is because she wants to be a princess.
Yeah.
And she becomes obsessed with the idea of being a princess in the same way that Rescuro becomes obsessed with the light, in the same way that, in a less creepy way than obsession, Despero becomes kind of obsessed with the princess.
Yeah.
And so, like, all of these obsessions drive their stories all into, you know, the final chapter, or I guess the final book in book four, where finally we entangle all of these characters fully. And because of the fact that she isn't the smartest by the books, you know, by the book's word, not my own, she's easy for Rescuro to, you know, manipulate. and convinced that by bringing P down into the dungeon, it will allow her to be a princess, promising her everything, you know, she could ever want, even though that is just simply ridiculous. And the book even points it out to us as early as it's first offered as absolutely ridiculous,
right,
and to know that it's not possible and that nobody would mistake these two people for the same people. And so I think that we see this manipulation of the want, that she believes she's going to finally get everything she ever dreamed of, only to be told, like, no, I'm going to leave you here in the dungeon too, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can swing that knife around, but I'm just going to leave you. To finally being asked, what do you want? And it's something that no one can give her, you know, nobody can bring her mom back, nobody can actually fulfill that wish, just like nobody can really fulfill the wish of her being a princess. But she still gets a happily ever after where, like, we are told explicitly, well, no, she is treated as a princess.
Yes,
she does get what she wants because her dad, who has been in the dungeon and very remorseful and sad, mm-hmm. told all of this to Rescuro much earlier on, is freed and treats her as a princess for the rest of the days that they're together. And I think that, like, that is a great example. Just like a rat who is in love with the world or the light is not going to be able to remain in the light right. forever. And just like a mouse who is in love with a princess is not actually able to marry a princess. Like, mm-hmm. you can get your happily ever after and still have these things be true. You know, you
right.
can still be a rat and you can still be a mouse and you can still be a servant girl, mm-hmm. but, like, you can still have all of these things and dreams and whatever. It just might not look exactly how you imagined it would coming out of a storybook.
Yeah. I love
and that. I think
that,
like,
yeah.
this book sets up a really beautiful precedent for storybooks by it not being the perfect, you know, like, yeah. cookie cutter, and then they lived happily ever after. Like, I think the book even says, but the question you want answered, I know, is did they live happily ever after? Yes. ... And no.
No. Mm-hmm.
And I think that is so cool from a children's book to be like, yeah, they did, but not necessarily in the way that you probably expect when you are finishing this book. Like, what mm-hmm. happened to them? Well, this, which was great, but also mm-hmm. this is still true. And this, yeah. which was great, but also this was still true. And I think that, like, the fact that it's like, we know that somewhere out there, Despero obviously didn't marry the princess, but he's out there on adventures with her. And, like, isn't that still love? Like,
right.
again, and so many beautiful, like, in this last chapter, you know, in this yeah. last moment of happily ever after that is set up, like, here's all of these lessons that have been set up throughout the entire book, wrapped up tightly in a nice little bow. I hope you feel good. And it gives you all of, like, the answers that the whole book has been
yeah.
asking. Where could you possibly go with a mouse being in love with a princess? Where could you possibly go with a mouse
right.
being in love with a princess? Well, they can be friends. Like, mm-hmm. and it's, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And that's still a happily ever after. And I think, like, again, such a cool way for a book to set up, like, teaching lessons, because it could have obviously been a mouse princess that he goes and saves.
Right.
And they could have gotten married and it could, you know, and, like, it would have changed obviously parts of this story, but it's still, like, if they wanted the stereotypical romance, you can do mm-hmm. warrior cats, you know, you
right.
can, you can set everybody up on the same playing field, but by recognizing that there was no way to have a perfect happily ever after, it teaches everyone that searching for the perfect happily ever after might not actually be happily ever after. Like,
yeah.
you can still find it if it's not what you thought it was going to be in your brain when you first conjured the image. And I think
yeah.
like that's a really cool lesson for children as early as second grade. Like, how cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I was so glad to reread this book because I knew it was important, but all I really remembered was, I guess I read it in second grade, and then third grade, I think there was some kind of project that I decided to do on this. And I made some kind of god ugly piece of art that was like coat hangers and red thread. And it was like maybe like a mobile. And it was so ugly. But I remember like fiercely loving the book previously before today. I have talked about the movie and I never saw it because the animation alone was like, oh, you did not crack that book open once. Like the illustrations are so purposeful.
So I was hoping you would bring up the movie because I specifically said the other day, I now need to go back and rewatch the movie purely through the level of hatred that I already remember having for it. So, okay, it came out, I want to say in like 2008. At that point, the book had mattered to me for, you know, enough time that I was like, okay, cool. I'm ready. I can't wait. I'm like so excited to like see this movie because I think I was so happy they were tackling a book with like themes like this.
Yeah.
You know, like I was like, cool, that's going to be really like, how are they even going to tackle all of the scenes with like her ears being beaten or with, you know, tails being cut off or, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like super interested in how they were going to tell this story. I was obviously like so ready for like it to be cheesy, but like, still true, right? True to text. And then I remember seeing, I think it was in one of the trailers, a soup man. And I mean that like a man made out of vegetables and pots. And I was like, who is this? What is this?
Oh my God.
What's happening here? And so at that point, I was then dedicated to just go watch the movie because I was like, how bad did they fuck
up? Oh my
God. Now I need to know like what they did to my book. And if I remember correctly, because
I have to look up pictures. Yeah.
It's bad, dude. They changed the cook to a man, which I was like, boo. And also like no reason to do that. He has a soup companion, this magic soup man god who comes together. I can't explain it to you, Aaron. I hope that people look this up as they're listening to this.
I mean, the animation style is just undefensible. It's just disgusting.
And I could be wrong, but if I remember correctly, instead of Respiro coming from the dungeon, he came from a pirate ship.
Oh no.
I believe that, or he leaves on a pirate ship, one or the other, maybe both, unclear. But I distinctly remember, like in the book, we're introduced to a locket that, oh, what's his name?
Charlie.
Yeah, thank you. Wears and swings around when he talks and whatnot. It's like a really minor part of the book.
Oh yeah.
He wears this thing, he swings it around when he speaks. It is shiny, so it like keeps Riskiro's interest. But like otherwise it's kind of like just a character detail. In the movie, I distinctly remember it being like a big deal. Like they have to take the locket and hang it somewhere and it shines some light, and in the shining of the light, like I'm like, okay, I need to revisit it now that I've revisited the book, because again, I was reminded just how much I love this book and love the content that it was telling to children, like the way that it took children so seriously, like, and it was like, you can handle these concepts. These are not things that like are outside of the realm of your understanding. Like you are able to handle this level of bad things happening in the world. And to take something that on the cover literally says American literature for children and put so little into the movie.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, then why did you make, like, if you couldn't show stuff that was written in the text because it was too graphic, why did you make the movie?
Yeah. I did find an image of the soup man for listeners. If you know the portrait, Giuseppe Arcimboldo portrait of people whose faces are made up of different vegetables, it's that guy. And even the character is named after that artist, Boldo. And this is disgusting.
And why is his head, okay, guys, he's supposed to make up soup. Why is his head a watermelon?
Head is a watermelon. Cheeks are apples. Beard is grapes.
We get an explicit explanation of what's in the soup. And it's like garlic and
chicken
and like broth. And it's apparently wonderful. And like simple soup, there is zero fruit in it. Why is this not a watermelon? Why are there apples? What's going on? Who is this man?
This is awful.
So bad. It's so bad.
Oh, wow.
I'm almost fascinated by it on the level of like what the point, because I don't feel like this book was popular enough to warrant that kind of or movie. I'm confused who the movie was for. Because, like, at this point, it had been how many years since the book had come out?
Maybe 4 or 5.
A lot. Quite a few. And so, like, I know that a lot of people read this book, but I also don't feel like it was popular enough as a book to warrant creating a movie.
Right.
That also was not going to be anything like the book. I feel like it was too niche of a book where, like, you were just going to disappoint everyone who did love the book because it's nothing like the book.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who didn't read the book wasn't interested in the story to begin with. So why did you?
Yeah.
Even if it's not going to be the story, why did you? Like, and I think that's what confused me about, like, the creation of this movie in general, is I was just like, who greenlit this and was like, this is an awesome idea and kids are gonna love it. This man, this soup man, he's the guy. Like,
it just makes me afraid to ask, do you remember if there are songs in it?
Oh, are there? See, I want to say no.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a like cooking song. There might be a song with that man. Exactly. Like, precisely. I know there's some kind of like spell thing that the cook does, and I don't know if he does like a, but like he like literally like puts all of the things into a pot, does some sort of spell, and then it turns into the soup man with the pot on his head.
Oh no.
I like vividly remember it, and I was like, I think I hate everything about this, but I can't definitively remember if there were songs. Mm-hmm. I want to say no, but maybe one.
I feel like odds are kids movie in the 21st century, at least 50-50.
Yeah. 50-50.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, obviously not many movies, especially in that time, that were coming out of source material that was children's books, was actually like good.
Yeah.
But it's, I did have like some kind of hope that it would at least be truer to story. Like, especially because at this point, you know, we had already had stories like Secret of Nim, you know, mm-hmm. and gotten animated versions of Secret of Nim that were very dark.
Right.
And like, I wasn't expecting Secret of Nim level dark, but I still was expecting like it to take the themes of this story seriously. And it just was like, no, here's a soup man. Here's some really bad animation.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not gonna watch it. I just feel like a better life that way.
It's probably a waste of the probably 2 hours that it would cover in your life, but I'm going to re-hate watch it and take notes about everything I hate, and I'll send them your way.
Thank you. More power to you. Yeah.
Just going back to the fact that this is ultimately a story about forgiveness and like fate.
Yeah.
And like challenging fate, but ultimately accepting that you can mm-hmm. both challenge and accept fate. Like, I hope that more people who haven't visited this book,
mm-hmm.
especially people who are like older, who never visited this book, will visit it.
Yeah.
And I know that's kind of like a crazy hope, I guess, because it's however many years old at this point. And if you haven't read it at this point, you probably don't have an interest in it. But like I said, it's such an easy read. You can read it in an afternoon if you sit down and just dedicate your mind to it. And like, despite it being a children's book, like, I really think that it's just a phenomenal story for everyone.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the big messages I get from it is that like, you are capable of change and you can always turn back, and that everyone is a lot more similar on the inside than perhaps we even realize. Like that moment at the end with P, where she realizes like you have to choose to put out light in the world, that I think will stick with me for a long time. Yeah, this book is, I think, I don't know, it came back to me at a really good time.
Yeah, I really was so impressed by the pacing,
mm-hmm.
but also just all of the themes. Like, I was like, wow, these are both so adult and so like great for like developing minds simultaneously. Yeah. And like, I want to read this start right here, because I think that this kind of capsulates the whole thing. The world is dark and light is precious. Come closer, dear reader. You must trust me. I am telling you a story.
Yeah. Would you consider it required reading?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I really do. I'm shocked that I was like, I stumbled upon this story by myself. And like, I know that's how most people stumbled upon it. There was no like actual requirement at any point. Yeah. It was either something you picked up or something you didn't. And so I hope that it gets more of the love it deserves, because it is such a fucking good story.
It is. I love it. It's so sweet. And it does it. It's just affirming is the word I settled on a few hours ago. It's just affirming.
And it makes you really look at how the underdog story is really everyone's story, you know, like all of these different characters, like no one really is the villain, right? I think that's like a beautiful message in it too. Like, because we get everyone's perspective at some point, like Riscuro's villain is P, you know, and like P's villain is Riscuro. But we also know that like for Despero, he views Riscuro also as one of his enemies. Riscuro doesn't even know that Despero really exists, you know, like, because you get everyone's story and everyone's points of view, even down to like some of the characters who we don't like Lester, who is in book one, like you said, a very tragic father figure who marches his son to death, who then by book four gets forgiveness. Like all of these really beautiful arcs of like people who do bad things don't always do bad things because they're bad people. Sometimes they just are given circumstances that lead them to do these bad things. And by offering them light, sometimes that's the only way to actually cure the darkness in the world, you know?
Beautiful
storytelling.
It is.
Yes, required.
Absolutely. Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to plug as we round out?
Oh my goodness. No.
Okay.
No, I think I'm good.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much to Jess for coming on. If you'd like to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/required reading. It's the name of the show. I'm just having difficulties today. You can donate any amount you want, any frequency you want, including one time. For example, your money goes to buying the next book I'm reading. Next episode, next week, Grace Baylor is joining me to discuss the first book in Allie Carter's Gallagher Girls series. That's the phrase that's really tripping me up. I'd tell you I love you, but then I'd have to kill you. Love it. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. The R stands for raunchy. Why not? Thank you.